reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honors. I'm Carl Gunn. I'm representing Mr. Kinney. Subject to the court directing me elsewhere, I'm going to focus my sentencing argument on the California kidnapping conviction for a couple of reasons. First, you already heard argument on the armed bank robbery 924C issue. Second, the Armed Career Criminal Act enhancement has a much bigger impact on Mr. Kinney's sentence. And third, frankly, at the risk of advocate bias, I frankly think the California kidnapping issue is an extremely strong issue, and the court really needs to give it a serious look.
Well,
the court will do that.
Maybe, but maybe not. And let me just ask you this. You conceded in your reply brief that the Plain Error Review does apply to this issue, or not? That's what
I'm saying. Well, actually, I conceded in my opening brief, too, when I said about the standard of review.
So, if that's true, then I don't know how we could do much of a searching analysis on this issue.
Well,
because, just to help answer this, so this was to say the first problem of the Plain Error analysis, that it's clear and obvious, right? What the title of the crime itself certainly suggests that it's a crime of violence, right?
Kidnapping.
For purpose of robberies. Well, now it's just that I know it's not just straight kidnapping, but yes, even kidnapping.
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because kidnapping actually can be a lot of different things in a lot of different jurisdictions. So at the very least, you've got to look at the language in the statute.
Well, I think it is. Tell me what this first problem is. Because the district court judge, again, the pre-sentence report, let's just say it's a kidnapping, straight up common law kidnapping, right? The defense lawyer is not saying any objections to the pre-sentence report. No, we're good with it. Why would I, as a district court judge, think, oh, you know what, I better break out the statute and go through and check the California cases to see if this is really a crime of violence?
Well, two things, Your Honor. First of all, we start when he mentioned the defense attorney not making any objections. And then my second issue, which I don't want to get to, but first of all, let me answer. I don't think it's obvious just because the statute uses the word kidnapping. I think that what's obvious here are two things that, taken together, make the error obvious. First of all, it is obvious from Johnson 1 on defining force, and from the opinion I think Your Honor actually wrote in, I believe it's Dominguez Mariocchi, that the force has to be violent force capable of causing pain or injury. And three examples of things that are not violent force are the ones you listed in Dominguez Mariocchi: chasing a person and bumping him, walking up to a person and jolting his arm, grabbing a person by her jacket. That is obvious. Those two legal principles are obvious. And I think you look beyond the statute language to get to that. Then what is also obvious is what the California case law establishes qualifies as kidnapping. I think under a plain error review, you do look at the underlying case law, especially for a statute defining called kidnapping, because kidnapping can mean lots of other different things.
I mean, you've done a magnificent job, I think, in your brief, laying out all of the nuances of California cases that have this.
But, Your Honor, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I really don't think they're nuances. I mean, it's plain there in the face of about seven or eight cases that things just like pulling on someone's jacket qualify. Pulling someone into a car qualifies.
Nuance in the sense that if I didn't have someone direct my attention to those cases, I would not have guessed that California defined kidnapping down to the level that it does.
I think any reasonable attorney or judge would know that kidnapping varies in different jurisdictions, so just the word kidnapping means nothing. I think that is obvious. The second then to find out what kidnapping means, it's obvious that you have to look at the state statute and case law. The state statute says force. After Johnson, it's obvious that force means different things in different jurisdictions. So you have to look at the case law for the examples of what force are. And the case law makes it obvious that something like pulling on someone's jacket and getting them into a car is force. It makes it obvious that someone threatening to unlawfully arrest someone is force. It makes it obvious that in the case of a child victim, just carrying the child somewhere is force. It makes it obvious that telling a parent, I'm going to take your child, is force. So it really is, I think, the plain error case law uses the word obvious for that prong. It's obvious that kidnapping can mean different things in different jurisdictions. It's obvious that the force is
really keen
mean different things, or that you would only think that it means different things.
I'm sorry, say that again.
You take the position that kidnapping can mean different things because of the things you've reviewed.
Not just can, does.
But doesn't it mean something on the face also? When you say kidnapping, you're not talking about a nice thing.
No.
Necessarily.
Or you're talking about a crime. But
what's thought to be a very serious crime?
Well, but you're not talking about force unless, depending on the jurisdiction, there's lots of jurisdictions that make kidnapping by fraud. In fact, California now.
I understand the point you're making, but getting back to what Judge Walker was mentioning earlier, as a district judge, you suggested that it is so plainly obvious that it's not so obviously serious that every judge without an objection from either counsel would automatically know to research kidnapping.
I want to be sympathetic with district judges, Your Honor.
I'm actually being
I'm not criticizing the district judge here, but plain error is a little bit more than we claim the district judge. I mean,
were so obvious you can hit that you should have spotted it without the background.
And or his assistant, the probation officer, perhaps. But I guess where I go, Your Honor, is it is obvious that kidnapping means different things in different jurisdictions. I mean, I think everybody knows that. So then it then becomes obvious that you have to look and see what kidnapping means in California.
No, I grant you the first part, that it does mean different things in different jurisdictions. But until I read your brief, have any clue what California courts have said kidnapping means. But if a district judge has that case in front of them and the defendant makes no objection, why would I think that, in fact, California defines kidnapping in a way that doesn't qualify as a crime of violence? I would have assumed if that's true, I would hear from someone like yourself telling me.
But it's not plain error just because a defense attorney, you don't get around plain error just by a defense attorney not making an objection, or otherwise you'd never have plain error reversal, right? I mean, there have to be some situations where the lack of an objection, there's still plain error.
I think you could have said robbery after Dixon, right? The sentencing was after Dixon. If it said robbery, it's 11 robbery, that would have been plain error. Because, well, we have a case from our circuit that says that it does not qualify.
Actually, this was kidnapping after a Ninth Circuit case that held it was kidnapping only under the residual clause. Now, if you look, you would then have to look carefully to find out that statutory provision only took effect in 1990. So there was here a case that said California kidnapping doesn't qualify under the force clause that existed at the time.
Yeah, but that was a different kidnapping. But
if you're going to give the judge sort of the excuse or explanation of knowing there's a different statute in 90, then I think he also has the responsibility of looking at what the statute was in 90. He would see the word force.
We're talking about the 74 version, right? Not the 93.
Right. He'd have to look at what it was before 90. And the one before 90 uses the word force, but he knows after Johnson that force means different things.
Otherwise seems like this is going to be a match. And if it weren't, because California has this, a different version from what one would typically expect.
I don't think it's different from what one would typically expect, frankly. It's all over the map.
What's the common law definition of kidnapping?
It's
through use of force or intimidation, something like that. Takes someone to a different location.
It wouldn't surprise me if a majority of states include kidnapping by fraud. I know there's lots of states that do. Your Honor, since we're on this issue, let me talk about why he should have gotten a new attorney, in which case there would be a remand anyway, and then this obviously could be dealt with, because I'm sure any attorney on remand would raise this issue, especially after I talked to him and showed my briefs, if nothing else. The government says it's Mr. Kinney's fault because he stopped talking to his attorney. That is clearly not dispositive under this court's case law, because I've cited you at least four cases.
And is it the fourth lawyer?
Yes.
Number four. He's already gotten rid of three.
Right.
Number four.
Right. Though he worked with each lawyer through a stage of the proceedings, I think there's good reason to think he would have worked with a new lawyer through sentencing. I've given you cases that say him not meeting with the attorney is enough, and look at what this attorney did. look at what this attorney did, Your Honors. I'm not going to try to use too harsh language, but first of all, he knows Mr. Kinney, in his own words, in the attorney's own words, as someone who likes to dot his I's and cross his T's. I asked my wife the other day, is that a bad thing? And she said, well, no, not necessarily. I think in a criminal case where someone's facing 27 years, you probably want to dot your I's and cross your T's. He knows Mr. Kinney, someone like that. He just shows up someday with a probation officer to do a pre-sentence interview. No meeting to prepare. Then what does he do? Mr. Kinney says, no, I want to prepare. He sends Mr. Kinney a pre-sentence report packet to fill out. In his cover letter, he says, this is due by January 22nd. Mr. Kinney assumes he has till January 22nd. Then the attorney shows up with the probation officer again on January 20th, and Mr. Kinney hasn't had a chance to fill that out. So on that side of the prong, I would submit it was hardly unreasonable. It was hardly manufactured discontent, which is the language used in the cases, for Mr. Kinney to say, I want a new attorney.
What preparation would Mr. Kinney be involved in to change things? Because I guess he's reviewing it to see whether he has some objections, but it's the lawyer's responsibility to be prepared for the
evaluation. When I was acting trial lawyering for a long time, Your Honor, before I started doing just appellate practice, I always wanted to meet with my clients and prepare them to make a good impression.
I'm not arguing that. I'm saying the issues that you have. The matter you have issue with is the matter of kidnapping, and that was not objected to.
Actually, not just that. Well, that's my view. But let me, what I'm arguing, Your Honor, under the case law, the question is whether Mr. Kinney was reasonable and had a reason to not want to meet with his attorney or want a new attorney. And I'm saying when someone is a person who wants to be prepared and their attorney just shows up with a probation officer.
Yeah, but my point is, what is it that he's preparing that you're pointing us to other than the failure of the lawyers to raise the objection with the county?
Just getting him ready to present a good impression. I'm not arguing here the ineffective assistance. I'm arguing under the case law about new attorneys that he had a good reason to be dissatisfied. And that's not all, because look at what the attorney did when it came to sentencing. First of all, the attorney didn't do what I think after Discamps and Johnson any reasonable federal attorney would do, and that's look at the state case law for a kidnapping prior and find the argument I made. It is not, I sometimes make off-the-wall arguments, Your Honors. I get what they call creative, and what prosecutors sometimes call something else. This is not some creative off-the-wall argument. This is a solid, I would submit strong argument. I'm arguing to you it's plain. This argument should have been made, but that's not all. There are some attorneys out there who say, well, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a law lawyer. I go with the facts and the equities. So what else is there? At sentencing, what kind of argument did this attorney make? And this goes to the issue of abandonment of the client, which is another factor in deciding whether a request for new counsel is reasonable. What does he do? The guideline range here is, I think, 272 to 319 months. You have a 65-year-old man. Probation recommends the high end, 319. Your Honor, as a district judge, how often do attorneys come in and agree to the high end when the prosecutor is not even asking for something more? What does this attorney do? He comes in and just says, submit on the probation report. And he doesn't just say, submit, I have nothing to offer. He asks the judge to follow the probation report, which is the high end. He doesn't even say to the judge, well, gee, Your Honor, we have a 65-year-old man here. I think 272 months is going to get him into prison to his 80s is enough. So under the case law, Your Honor, I've given you four cases that say even when the defendant stops meeting with his attorney, requests for substitute counsel sometimes has to be granted. And the test is whether there was this, what the case is called, manufactured discontent, or whether it was reasonable for the defendant to want a new attorney. Here it was reasonable because he just wanted to be prepared for the pre-sentence interview, and he has a defense attorney who twice shows up without even giving him any notice of it, let alone meeting with him to prepare. And second, you have a defense attorney who engaged in absolutely no sentencing advocacy at all, and in fact affirmatively asked the court to give him the high end of a 272-month to 319-month range instead of the low end. I hope I can sell some time for rebuttal. So I obviously have other issues. And I would also, I, the court look real carefully at the plain error context, but you don't need to get there if you send it back for a new attorney anyway.
Okay. We'll give you some time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Ross Peterson for the government. I'd actually like to start with an issue that the panel hasn't touched on yet, which is this suppression issue. And Kenny, in his reply, notes that it was unreasonable for the police to use the amount of force they did for this detention, because all they knew was that they were dealing with an armed bank robber. I think, though, that it's precisely the case that they were dealing with an armed bank robber that made this use of force reasonable. That's from this court's Miles case, which says police may use more intrusive detention tactics when they have reason to believe the suspect is armed or when the encounter closely follows a violent crime. That's what the police had in this case. They had a dispatch report that a defendant or a suspect had just robbed a bank with a gun, that he was headed eastbound, that he was fleeing on a bike and had a helmet. And within 3 minutes of that report, only a quarter of a mile away, and on the first street that you would turn on if you were headed eastbound from this bank, Officer Parsons encountered the defendant. Under those circumstances, the safety threat is what justified his use of drying out his guns, ordering Kenny out of the car, and eventually handcuffing him and placing him in the back of the squad car. And that's what distinguishes this case from the cases that Kenny cites, Ricardo D. or Krause or Washington versus Lambert, where this court went to great lengths to say there's no bright line rule of when a detention becomes an arrest.
I wondered about that, that they could make that tie so quickly, considering that the defendant had left the bank on a bicycle with a helmet on. Now he's in another vehicle with no helmet and no bicycle. That's pretty thin. He's just having to be another car coming down the road.
I disagree that it's thin, Your Honor. I believe it's sufficient for a reasonable suspicion to detain him. And that's also because the van was parked on a street that the officer, in his years of work, had never seen a van parked there. And the defendant was walking around the back of a van wearing long clothing, even though it was a warm day. The fact that it's a van, I think, is significant, too, because the defendant could have placed a bike in there just as he actually did. Now, under those circumstances, it was reasonable for the officer to pull the vehicle over and order him out. A fact that came out at trial, which under this court's precedent in Sanford, which is 673 F2nd 1070, this court can consider facts that come out at trial even if they're not at the suppression hearing. And at trial, Officer Parsons testified that when Kenny was on the ground at gunpoint, even before he was handcuffed or placed in the squad car, that Kenny said that there was a gun in the car. Before he was placed in the squad car, Officer Hart frisked him and found a loaded magazine cartridge and a police scanner that was tuned to the Modesto police station. So even before he was placed in the squad car, even before he was handcuffed, there was at least reasonable suspicion, but I believe it needed probable cause.
Now, there definitely was a probable cause. I don't even know why you're trying to make that argument. You barely have reasonable suspicion. Why do you move to the other issues that counsel actually did address?
Yes, Your Honor. So, on the issue for a new attorney, the defendant, there must be limits on the defendant's ability to get a new attorney when he's manufacturing conflict, which is what he does here. And he focuses a lot of his attention on this issue with the timing of the pre-sentence report interview. But it's not just the PSR. The issue that Kenny couldn't move past with any of his four attorneys was that he lost his suppression hearing. And on day three of trial, right before closing arguments, he asked for a new attorney. He mentioned it. He said that he recognized in ER 229 that the main issue in this case was suppression, and that none of his four attorneys had been able to elicit any of the facts he had hoped they'd be.
Yes, that's significant. I hope that, as counsel, opposing counsel said, that a defendant should be able to have the time to review the pre-sentence investigation report and to discuss it fully with his attorney. Would you agree with that?
I do agree that that's important, but I think what the court recognized and the reason it didn't abuse its discretion is it saw this suppression issue drive a wedge between each of his attorneys. And that's why this case is so similar to Mendez-Sanchez, where the defendant had his first attorney, the attorney would try to discuss evidence with him, the defendant would leave the room.
Listen, does the record indicate to you of what the underlying reason was? What was it specifically he needed to have to prepare for? I asked counsel about that. It's just vague to say, I need to prepare. Was there some particular issue noted about the record, something that was particular to
not know, Your Honor. It's not clear what he wanted to prepare for. And I also note that in the PSR in this case, in paragraph 41, way back in 1984 when he committed his second armed bank robbery, he also refused to interview his probation at that time. So even this is a pattern, his refusal to interview, his refusal to listen to his attorneys. And the district court recognized that. It said that on day three of trial, it said that it wasn't talking about the suppression issue anymore. Kennedy's attorney said that Kennedy kept wanting to relitigate the suppression issue, that he couldn't move past it. And the
post interview conduct of counsel in sentencing as a part of his decision into whether or not it was appropriate to deny the change of attorney.
I believe the court can consider that conduct, and that's from this court's Walker case that the defendant cites, where the defendant asked for a new attorney prior to trial, and then during trial it was clear that he and his attorney weren't communicating. His attorney even said that they weren't communicating, and that because of that, she was unable to put on any defense. But I also disagree with the argument that his attorney abandoned him at sentencing. And even though he didn't object to the PSR, that he...
What did he do? He didn't do anything. I don't know how you can come to any other conclusion.
So at this phase, the record is fairly undeveloped about what went into his decision not to object, but we actually have a little hint of it at ER 47. Kennedy, when he was speaking at sentencing, went through a laundry list of issues that he had with his case, and during that elocution, he noted that his attorney had sent him a letter. In the letter, the attorney said that he had done research on the PSR, and that although the recommendation was high, that challenging it might be futile and even counterproductive. And it's that counterproductive part, I believe, that's significant because it recognizes that Kennedy had two prior armed bank robberies. Those ones missed getting criminal history points by just a little over a year. If those had been scored, he would have been looking at a guideline range of 360 to life.
I can't remember if you were involved in the trial court level or not.
No.
Okay, but so your colleague, you guys weren't asking for anything about the attorney.
It's not clear, Your Honor. And
it's not clear. Tell me what the... you guys know what your position was in sentencing. You asked for buy-in, right? That's what probation recommended. Nobody was suggesting that an upward departure was in you, right?
That's right. We submitted on the recommendation of probation for 319 months.
I mean, maybe you're right. I don't know the defense counsel. I haven't talked to him. Maybe you have. So I don't know if in his own mind he thought there was some risk that asking for low end would be counterproductive. I would be shocked if that were in any way a reasonable strategy going into a sentencing, especially as you're focused on for a 65-year-old man. That's the amount of time he wants to sentence. I mean, to hear you say that the defense lawyer is not the independent. Mr. Kennedy, I think, is outrageous. I've read that transcript and could not believe how deficient the performance was. And I understand why Mr. Kennedy is wanting a lawyer. And I would wager that you and I, if we were in his shoes, would damn sure not want him to be represented by a lawyer.
And again, Your Honor, at this case, we don't know what went into that decision. But the letter is really the hint that we have right now. I do believe that his attorney thought, based on his statement, that it could possibly be counterproductive, that it could have gotten worse. At the very least, it shows that he wasn't just sitting back and doing nothing. And again, that's why the district court did abuse its discretion earlier, is that it saw that this issue with Kennedy had manifested itself repeatedly through his number of attorneys. The court recognized that and even stated that Kennedy still wanted to talk about the motion to suppress, even through trial, through sentencing, even when it wasn't a viable issue. And that's why this case is closer to Mendez-Sanchez than cases like Adelzo-Gonzalez or Velasquez. In Adelzo-Gonzalez, the attorney was openly threatening his client in court. He stated that he was going to sink his client for 105 years if he didn't accept the plea. Or he called his client a liar. He even tried to prevent his client from presenting a motion for a new attorney to the court, saying that his client was going to obstruct justice.
Let me ask you this, then. Just one more question before I want to ask you about the kidnapping thing. If I remember it right, this lawyer that we're talking about, and he didn't affirmatively oppose the effort to have him removed. And I remember Mr. Kennedy saying in sentencing, I don't know if he was trying to the guy, he said, I don't even understand why you fought to case down this case because you didn't do anything for me. And I kind of said, why did the, why was he opposing Kennedy's motion to have him replaced? He just turned around and basically did nothing to help him.
Yeah. Well, 2 points on that. So, first off, his attorney did opposed it. He said, I want to stay on this case. He said, we're still communicating. He also spent some time clarifying some of the factual claims that Kenny had made against him. So Kenny, for instance, said that his attorney had been cramming the night before trial, and his attorney disputed that, or they disputed when they met, what time, and what they discussed, and Kenny's attorney responded to that. But the mere statement that I want to stay on the case, or I'm prepared, I'm ready to go forward, doesn't show that there's an irreconcilable conflict or that there's a breakdown. That actually happened in Dundas-Sanchez, where the attorney said, we're still trying to communicate. He just doesn't want to listen to us when we talk about evidence with him. And so, in that case, the court still affirmed and found that it wasn't an abuse of discretion. And the fact that Kenny's attorney did essentially the same thing that the attorneys did in Mendez-Sanchez, where he said, we're still communicating, I'm still ready to go forward, doesn't necessarily have evidence to break down. Yeah, and Your Honor, I agree with your statement that it's not plain error in this case. And even if the court had broken out the statute and pulled it up and read the cases say that for California kidnapping for robbery, the defendant must use force or threat of force. And even the cases that Kenny cites at least arguably fall within the scope of Johnson's definition of violent force, which is force capable of causing physical pain, similar to a slap. Kenny notes that in LaSalle, the defendant threatened the victim, saying, if you want your child, you'll have to get in the car with me. And in LaSalle, the court noted that it's not just an empty threat, it's that threat that if you don't get in this car, I'm going to hurt your child, that makes it kidnapping for robbery. In Camden, for instance, the victim was pulled into a car. The defendant drove 60 to 70 miles an hour down the freeway so she couldn't jump out. And then when she tried to get out, the defendant turned the car and slammed the door into her, which caused her to stay in the car. Eventually, she jumped out and sustained injuries when she was bailing. These cases show that it is violent force. It's force capable of causing physical pain. Perhaps the outer limits of California kidnapping for robbery would be People versus Castro, which is where the defendant was driving up alongside the victim, said, I'll give you $10 if you let me lick you, then got out of the car and grabbed the victim, pulled her toward the car. And he pulled her hard enough that she took two steps toward the car. And the court said that that was force sufficient for kidnapping for robbery, which is close and similar to a slap in the face. But significantly, the court in that case noted that if the defendant had just grabbed and turned the victim, that wouldn't have been enough force. And so, at the very least, these cases show that it wasn't plain error for the district court to consider California kidnapping to robbery to be a violent felony.
The offense was just straight kidnapping, right? That's what you actually pleaded guilty to.
I pleaded it was kidnapping for robbery.
Did you write the brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
You got it right in the brief. I mean, the pre-sentence report says kidnapping for purposes of robbery or some nonsense like that, but I think we know that that charge was dismissed and actually pleaded guilty just to straight kidnapping. That's what you said in the brief.
The only difference with the for robbery part is that the victim must be taken and moved for an amount of time that's not just incidental. And so the amount of force would be the same still. And I believe that the district court, even if it had the benefit of full briefing on the issue, these cases fall within Johnson's definition of violent force because it's more force than just bumping a victim, grabbing a victim's jacket, spitting in a victim's face. Those are all the examples from Dominguez, Romero, and Yoki. And in these cases, it's more than that. It's pulling a victim into a car. It's pushing a victim, threatening to arrest a victim, which still carries the implied threat that if the victim doesn't comply, that the arrest would be completed using force. And so, at the very least, it's not plain that these cases fall outside the scope of Johnson's definition of violent force. And that's why the kidnapping for robbery was properly considered. And at the very least, this court should affirm on plain error review.
Kidnapping. Okay, do you have anything else?
No, Your Honor, the panel has no questions.
Okay, I think not. Thank you very much. Let's give you 2 minutes for a while.
First, go through a little laundry list of notes I made about the points my opposing counsel made on the attorney's representation. What they said, well, he said at the hearing they were still communicating. Seems to me as an officer of the court, he had an obligation to let the court know when that stopped because that communication stopped soon after the hearing on the 19th.
And in Delzo Gonzalez, he distinguished that by saying the attorney openly threatened to get his client under 5 years. Well, here the attorney actually asked for more time. He asked for the high end of the range. The attorney sent this letter about having done research and it would be futile and counterproductive. Well, I submit, given the research I've shown, Your Honors, that was pretty careless research. I'd also submit, just like I think Your Honor Judge Wofford suggested, I don't see any way how it's going to ever be counterproductive to just say this guy's going to be 80 when he gets out no matter what. Let's give him the low end of the range instead of the high end of the range. There's this argument that it's like Mendez-Sanchez, and it was going to be the same issue with another attorney. It wasn't going to be the same issue. Mr. Kinney at the sentencing, new sentencing counsel hearing, was not talking about the suppression issue. He was talking about sentencing stuff, certainly, in addition to it. He was generally unhappy. He didn't like being convicted, but he was talking about the sentencing stuff. And that's very different. Mendez-Sanchez, the judge drove his hands and said, listen, you're going to have the same problem with the ex-attorney. Well, Mr. Kinney wouldn't have the same problem here. The problem now was sentencing, and all he wanted to do was have an attorney who met with him before the interview and who researched the law carefully, made an objection, and who at the very least asked for the low end instead of the high end. You've got my briefing. I'm sorry.
Could you comment on counsel's argument that there is a reason not to bring it up because if they look at his priors, it's likely to go higher?
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. When the government's not even arguing for the high end, I don't see that as realistic at all. You have a guy who's been clean, if I can use the vernacular, for 15 years. He lived a period, and maybe there would have been more than just knowing he was clean for 15 years. If they'd been prepared for the pre-sentence interview, the defense attorney could have said what he'd been doing those 15 years. I don't see any realistic risk that by asking for the low end of the range and by making a legal argument about California kidnapping, that's going to be counterproductive or futile. You certainly don't. He could have at least been silent. He didn't have to actually say, give my client what probation recommends. I mean, Your Honor, I guess you're a district judge before the guidelines. Your Honor's a district judge for the guidelines. I mean, you go in and ask for 272 months instead of 319 months, and all of a sudden the judge is going to say, no, I'm giving more than probation's recommending. I can't imagine it. And you have a client here who just wants to dot every I and cross every T because he's facing lots of time. Is it so much for him to be upset when his attorney doesn't even meet with him before the pre-sentence interview and just shows up without telling him they're coming? That makes the breakdown in communication here not unreasonable and manufactured discontent, but reasonable discontent. You don't need to decide the kidnapping issue if you're going to remand on these grounds. I think you should. I think you have to look beyond the word kidnapping and deciding whether it is obvious. But at the very least, he deserved a new attorney. Therefore, I didn't get a chance to address the reasonable suspicion. But, Your Honor, I think it was more than thin here. Without a finding on the helmet issue, there was no way there was reasonable suspicion. You have someone in a public area, commercial residential area. He's a little bit rushed, not running like you'd expect a bank robber to be. He isn't on a bicycle when the robber's supposed to be on a bicycle.
I think I covered that.
Yeah, you covered that, Your Honor. I don't think there's reasonable suspicion with that. That's fine.
Thanks very much for your arguments. The case just argued will be submitted. We are going to take a short recess of 5 minutes. Okay. And we'll be back to the last case.